Like to welcome everyone to another edition of our Wednesday show. Thank you all for joining us. We always start our show with a prayer, the Lord's Prayer. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. Amen. Alrighty. Well, I just wanted to bring up something, and then we're going to go over to Larry, and then hopefully we'll have some time. Larry can leave a little time for Sean, because we got plenty to talk about tonight. But I wanted to just mention, there's so many crazy laws, you know, that California, my previous home state, passes. It's hard to, you know, hard to choose just one, but this one just kind of struck me, and I'll tell everybody why. So Newsom signs bill to police California doctors on COVID-19 misinformation. So, you know, maybe people don't really consider, especially those that don't have a license. I used to have a CPA license issued by the state of California, and it was revoked after 15 years of unbesmirched record. No client ever complained about any of my work, but the IRS decided one day to complain. And then that led to me having to self-report to the California Board of Accountancy that the IRS wasn't happy with me. And then that led to an administrative proceeding to which no jury ever decided on my conduct. It was an administrative law judge and, you know, railroading me into losing that CPA certificate. And, you know, things like that help you to learn what's important in life, because for many years, having CPA after my name was a big deal. And then I had to negotiate life once again without it. I wasn't born with it, and I won't be dying with it. But anyway, you know, the tax movement, freedom movement, whatever you want to call it, over the decades has been called names. A lot of name calling that goes on. Used to be that they could call you without any trial or due process whatsoever, an illegal tax protester. And then in the Restructuring Reform Act of 1998, they did away with that. I believe there a particular attorney that's a friend of ours had something to do with that, because he made an argument to the effect that putting a label like that on someone without any due process was a unconstitutional bill of attainder. And anyway, so the IRS DOJ did away with that, but they still found other names to call us, like tax denier, and they just would find other names that weren't in the statute. Anyway, so we're used to being called names. And of course, when we tell you what we believe and is actually the truth, because we show it to you in black and white, Larry will actually show it to you all the way back to 1913 and before that. So we like to show you the truth, but, you know, to the mainstream media and the government and the hyenas out there, we are providing misinformation to you, and we are tax deniers, et cetera. So I just thought it was a shame that the doctors now in California are being subjected to this, and not only name calling, which has gone on, you know, in the past, what do they call them? Disinformation specialists, or misinformation, mass information, misinformation spreaders. They never can come up with enough names for us all. But I just wanted to point out, it's a shame that now the doctors, especially all those that are really about the truth and are willing to speak the truth, are now going to be hamstrung, because their license will be on the line. And all I can say is that there is life after licensure. it's not the most fun. It's difficult. But it's just a shame that these licenses they claim are to protect the public, but they're nothing of the sort. The licenses are there to protect the status quo. And unfortunately, as time goes on, that becomes more and more apparent that there's a status quo that must be protected at all costs. And the heck with the hard work you put in to get your license, the heck with your desire to be truthful to the public and serve the public, especially your clients, your patients. That doesn't matter to the state, especially the state of California. So, John, you said that you recently had a show where you talked about this topic. So you have any comments?
Well, just, yeah, we did a radio show. Larry and I did a radio show on Friday and discussed what Gruesome Newsom out here in California was doing with this misinformation garbage, not under only under a new law, but he also included some new sections under the business code. But, you know, I pointed out that these doctors, they're human beings, and they deal with human beings, and they are have taken oaths to protect these people and to help them and to treat them accordingly, to improve their health, not to hurt them, which means telling them the truth. And if these doctors sit here in California and they're governed by this law and they're actually going to stay in this state, then I'd be aware of the doctors that stay here. If I was a doctor subject to this law, I'd be looking around saying, you know what, doctors are needed all over this country. I'm leaving California, getting a medical license in some other state. I'm not staying here and having some half-wit governor telling me what I can and can't tell my patients in private. I'd be gone. And you know what? Californians would be having to travel to see doctors. I wonder how that'd sit with Zy Gruesome Newsom. So that's my comments on it.
I don't think he'd be reimbursing anyone for mileage, that's for sure.
No, I don't think so.
Or putting them up in hotels, like for people that want to kill their babies.
Well, yeah, no. To get that, you have to be coming into the state to get an abortion. That's the only way you can get that money out. You're right.
Yeah. All right. Well, that was my little rant. And so, Larry, you had some information you wanted to share with the audience. Oh, he needs to be unmuted. Sorry. The way this Zoom works, everyone, is that if you mute yourself, then you have to be unmuted by me. So sorry, Larry, you're up.
Oh, no, the reason why I muted myself is because Charles called in, as he typically does. I don't know why he has a problem getting on, but I answered his phone call and he was already on. And I muted myself to talk to Charles. There he is at the bottom of the screen.
And Charles is unmuted. But Larry, you had some information you wanted to share?
Yeah, Joe, pull up the document I sent to you.
All right.
Now, this is real important. You know, I'd like for our little discussion group on Wednesday nights to get back to one of our original purposes, which is discussing the income tax. Now, I've spent decades studying the income tax laws. You know, back in the mid-80s, when I started out on this endeavor, I'd go to the law library, copy. You'd stick a dime in the copying machine, copy one page. And so when you sit there and you copy thousands of pages of statutes of large and thousands of pages of, you know, tax regulations, old stuff, it's real important because, you know, in the mid-80s, when I started digging into the income tax, I went back to the old laws. How did this get developed? You know, that's one of the things when I tackle any particular legal topic, you know, especially at the federal level, I like to go back and take a look at the history of that field of law or that specific law. You know, the history of a law is real important. So that's what I did with the income tax. And so I was copying all this stuff. And in order to study it, you know, if you're trying to look for patterns and stuff, you'd have to take your copy, stick them in a three-ring spiral-bound notebook, and then take a ruler. And you go down the page line by line by line, you know, just reading it in that fashion, looking for words. And that was extremely laborious. But then in the mid 90s, you know, here comes along, you got scanners that'll scan stuff. You know, I can remember back in the mid 90s, we were talking about how you might be able to get one page, a scan of one page on a floppy disk. But then, you know, late 90s, you know, I'd go up to the law library, and now you got on a CD-ROM, you got volumes of old federal statutes, old federal cases, the Supreme Court. Man, it was unbelievable. All this stuff is getting computerized. So then by the late 90s, you know, I saw that there was a way to, you know, there were some companies that were then on JPEG images, you know, making available the statutes at large. And so I determined that, you know, it would be very beneficial since, you know, sending, you know, back in those days, you know, if you wanted to send a copy to somebody, you would fax it to them. And it looked clear that soon it would be real possible that you could send by email copies of pages that have been copied. And so I sat out and I decided to, you know, convert all of the old tax acts and all the old regulations to PDF images and make them word searchable. And from there, I moved over to, eventually by the early, by 2002, by June or July, I had converted the entire United States statutes at large to PDF images and made them word searchable. And that's, you know, because I saw the benefit that could happen from making available materials that the most lawyers didn't have at that time, and certainly the public didn't have, you know, making the historical laws in reference to a particular subject matter, and especially for the income tax, making them available so they can be passed around on the internet or stuck on a CD and made available to people. So that's what I built. You know, by the early 2000s, and Joe, you have this, you know, my scans of, well, here's what I did in reference to the tax acts. I took the hard copies of the tax acts, converted them to text, and went line by line using ruler. I'd print out my copy of it, and I'd go through the original and compare that with my copy. And I produced, like you can see here on the screen, you know, that is, a lot of people will look at that page, you know, that's 1916, that's probably 39 stats, page 756. You know, most people would look at that and, well, that's the statutes at large. No, that is a text image. That's the text image that I created. And so I converted all of the old tax acts and all of the old regulations and put them on disk. And now you can pull up an HTML file and have access to, you know, just by pulling up one document, you can access everything else on that CD. And that's something that you have available for people, Joe. You know, for years you've made it available. Sean's got it. And if people would like to have this, and I encourage people to get it, you know, get Joe's, from Joe, my CD of the old income tax acts and regulations. Because you can pull up an HTML file. And if you want to pull up the 1913 Act, you just click on a link, just like on a website. And the 1913 Act comes up. My text conversion of it that looks like the original. If you want to pull up the 1916 Act, Revenue Act of 1918, which was passed in 1919, you can pull that sucker up. And they are PDF images. Since they're originally text, they are word searchable. Now, what my studies of the old tax acts was very revealing. And one of the things that I think is real important for people digging into the income tax, you know, I have found that tax professionals, tax lawyers, CPAs, nobody digs into the old stuff, the origins of it. You know, you talk to some tax lawyers and boom, they know the current Internal Revenue Code. You know, back in the old days, it was 1954 code, then it became the 1986 code. You know, they're only familiar with the current version, the code. That's what tax lawyers and tax accountants, that's what they use. They don't know anything about the history. You mentioned the old regulations to them, and they're out in left field. So it's not difficult for the average American, just with a little bit of studying, they can become familiar with the history. And once you become familiar with that history, you now know something that the tax professionals don't know. Now, one of the things that I think is real important is to show that all of these laws are interrelated. There's a connection. You can't sit there and say, you know, I'm going to look at the Revenue Act of the Income Tax Act of 1938 and completely divorce myself from, you know, the 1924 Act. The reason for that is because, and I'm going to show to you tonight, the interrelationship. And so once you see that interrelationship, that the A is connected to B is connected to C is connected to D is connected to E. Once you show that connection, they're all interrelated. That is a part of understanding this whole field of law known as the income tax. And once you understand the interrelated nature, you know, that is not difficult for the average American to understand. Oh, it's all connected. It really is. And that's something that most people don't know. Tax professionals don't know that. And the tax lawyers don't know that. Or, you know, they may have an indication of it, but why should I worry about the old stuff? You know, I'm only concerned about the here and now. But the, you know, if you ignore history, you're doomed to repeat it. And that's specifically, particularly in reference to the income tax. Without knowing the interrelated nature of it, you know, you can't see how this thing was built. And the subtle little things that were done, you know, that, demonstrate that, you know, there's something afoot. That there is an intent on the part of certain powers that be, you know, the tax authorities, to make this document appear to be broader than it really is. Now, Joe, you know, I prepared this afternoon and I emailed to you a 39-page document. And I can see you have that up on the screen and we're on page one, right? Yep. So now I want to go through these 39 pages and show to you how all the tax acts are related. Now, this is page 756. It'd be 39 stats, I guess, 756. Going down the page, because the 1916 Act there, chapter 463, that is the beginning of the 1916 Act. And off the top of my head, I think it was about, you know, 60 or 70 pages long. And by the time you get to the 1938 Act, you know, you're not talking about something that's 100, 120 pages long. So this is real important. Now, the first income tax, there was one during the Civil War, but the constitutionality wasn't challenged. But in 1894, Congress came along and passed another federal income tax. But this time around, there was a constitutional challenge to it. They went up all the way to the United States Supreme Court. And in the Supreme Court, a case called Pollock versus Farmers Loan and Trust, the Supreme Court said, hey, look, the income tax is a direct tax. And said that tax was not apportioned as required for direct taxes pursuant to the Constitution. It was unconstitutional. Then they came along in 1909, proposed the 16th Amendment. And on Joe's birthday in 1913, Philander Knox proclaimed, even though there were huge flaws with the ratification of the 16th Amendment, nonetheless, Philander Knox proclaimed it as being ratified. Now, as soon as the 16th Amendment was claimed to have been ratified, by October that year, Congress comes along and passes the first income tax, the 1913 Revenue Act, first income tax under the 16th Amendment. And again, that income tax act was challenged. And that challenge went all the way to the United States Supreme Court in a case called Bruce Shaver versus Union Pacific Railroad. The Supreme Court said, hey, look, you know, these people were arguing about the meaning of the 16th Amendment. And the Supreme Court, Justice White, just comes along and says, hey, look, the 16th Amendment doesn't say anything about amending any other provision of the Constitution. It's just setting forth a rule. And it says, and that rule is that income tax are not required to be apportioned. What tax laws of the United States are not required to be apportioned? Oh, the indirect taxes, chiefly the excise taxes. So in essence, the Supreme Court construed the 16th Amendment is only not authorizing a direct tax on income, but is whatever types of income taxes could fall within the classification of being an excise. Now, that's real important. Now, as a result of that Bruchhaber decision, Congress comes along. Here you got on the screen this October of 1916 law that was passed. This is the first income tax act after the Bruchhaber decision. So here you're coming along. You know, we're not going to get into the 1913 act, but if you want to look at it, you can get Joe's CD and have all this available to you. But here you can see, you know, that they came along and this 1916 act radically changed things. So section one says that there shall be levied, assessed, collected, and paid annually upon the entire net income received in the preceding calendar year from all sources by every individual, a citizen or resident of the United States, a tax of 2%. Okay, so they're imposing the tax. Now, Joe, let's go on down and take a look at. Here's something that people don't know about. You know, tax professionals, I've even had federal judges, you know, think, well, the 1913 Act was the first one that's still basically in effect. You know, that about Section 24 of the 1916 Act plainly repealed the 1913 Act. Look, Section 2 of the Act approved October 3rd, 1913, entitled An Act to Reduce Tariff Duties and to Provide Revenues for the Government and for Other Purposes, is hereby repealed. That's the 1913 Act. It was repealed. And so after the repeal, this is the first act after that. So, you know, I maintain, and you will see as we go through this presentation tonight, that, you know, the taxes imposed in 1916 is the tax we have imposed today. Now, so the 1913 Act is repealed by Section 24. Now let's move over to the next page, page 777 of this act, section 25. That income on which has been assessed the tax imposed by section 2 of the act entitled an act to reduce tariff duties and to provide revenues for the government and for other purposes, approved October 3rd, 1913, shall not be considered as income within the meaning of this title. Oh, so there's monumental differences between the 1913 income tax and the 1916. The 1913 is repealed, and hey, they've got something brand new in reference to income, starting with this 1916 Act, and that's exactly what Section 25 says on page 777. Joe, can you move over to, I don't know where the, you know, whether it's the left or right, move over to the left or the right so you can see the page number. Yeah, there it is, 777. Magical number. So now let's move forward. Let's move forward to the Revenue Act of 1918, adopted in 1919. It's coming up. Now, all I did is I took the, for the purposes of this presentation tonight, I just took certain selected pages from all of these acts and strung them together because there's a point I want to make. Now, here's the first page of the Revenue Act of 1918, approved February 4th of 1919. So now they're coming out, and this is the third act. You know, the 1916 Act was amended in, for our purposes, irrelevant respects. You know, they increased the rates during 1917 because we were in World War I. You know, but that's basically what the 1917 Act did. It just amended the 1916 Act. Here, however, we're imposing a tax in lieu of the tax imposed in 1916. So, Joe, let's go down. So this is the first page of the Revenue Act of 1918. So now we're going to go down a couple of pages over to part two, the tax imposed. Now you can see in lieu of that, in lieu of the taxes imposed by subdivision A, Section 1 of Revenue Act of 1916, and by Section 1 of the Revenue Act of 1917, there shall be levied, collected, and paid for each taxable year upon the net income of every individual. Oh, this is in lieu of. So in lieu of the tax imposed in 1916, we got this new tax. The subjects remain the same, They're basically, of course, as experience dictates with something new, you got to have up with these. As you work along administratively, you learn how this thing is progressing. You know, you begin to see the things you need to clarify. You know, that's the reason why basically every 2 years, you know, there's a new revenue act. And they're all imposed in lieu of the previous tax. So here, the 1916 Act is really the foundation for the tax imposed by the Revenue Act of 1918, adopted in 1919. So Joe, let's keep on going. Let's go to the next act, the Revenue Act of 1921. So here we have the first page of the Revenue Act of 1921. And, you know, here you see, oh, I want to mention here, just in passing, because Sean and I know this, and Joe knows, let's go on down a page. I think I may have seen the definition of the United States. I may have, yeah. Well, okay, it's in later ones. We'll get to it. So here you have in the Revenue Act of 1921. Oh, yeah, there it is. Okay, I got it highlighted in yellow. But, you know, we have a friend of ours is running around saying, well, gee, the United States is Washington, D.C. You know, that's the way the current code. You know, once you understand how this thing's built and how the definitions in Section 7701 of the Internal Revenue Code, that comes from all over the place. And so, you know, you can't sit there and say, well, the definitions that apply to Section 7701 have an effect upon, you know, all of the taxes in there. No, you got to look at the history. But, you know, but we have a friend of ours is sitting there and saying, say, United States means only the Washington, D.C., which is wrong. You can see here, what are we on? The Revenue Act of 1921, definition of the United States. Well, it's not limited to Washington, D.C. So, Joe, let's go on down. Let's go to the tax imposed section. There it is. Okay. Tax imposed, Section 210. That in lieu of the tax imposed with Section 210 of the Revenue Act of 1918, there should be levied, collected, and paid for each of the taxable years upon the net income of every individual. Oh, so the tax imposed by this was in lieu of the tax imposed in 1918, which was in lieu of the tax imposed in 1916 and 1917. So it's all interrelated. It's in lieu of. Okay, just let's move to the next tax, Joe. 24. Next page. 24. It'll be down through the bottom. Yeah. This act may be cited as the Revenue Act of 1924. And here we got the definitions. Oh, here, see, I did color this one in the definition of the United States. And I'm just mentioning that in passing. You know, we're not belaboring it. I just, for those that might be inquiring, well, gee, what does payment have to say? You know, gee, there's some flaws with that argument. So here we are in this tax, you know, in lieu of the tax imposed by Section 210 of the Revenue Act of 1921, there should be levied, collected, and paid for each taxable year upon the net income of every individual. So here we are in 24. The 24 tax was in lieu of the 21. 21 was in lieu of the 1918. And 1918 was in lieu of the 1916 and 1917 tax. It's that simple. And here, right in the tax imposed section, they tell you it is in lieu of. And you will see when we get up here in another couple more acts, oh, a new trick gets developed. And this is a trick, you know, once you see the interrelationship between all these tax acts, you can see these subtle little things that are done, like you're carving off the in lieu of, and then, you know, leaving out stuff. You know, we're going to cover it during the course of the night. So Joe, let's move to the next tax, the 26. There you go. Okay, it'll be further down the page. You know, this is a page out of the United States statutes at large, or at least by text conversion of it. So here we are with the Revenue Act of 1926. Okay, again, I highlighted the United States if you go further down the page. There it is. There's that definition of the United States, which is, it's not limited to Washington, D.C. Okay, Joe, let's go on down to the tax imposed section. 1926 Act, here we are, Section 210. In lieu of the tax imposed by Section 210 of the Revenue Act of 1924, there should be levied on every individual. Okay, so 26 was the Lou of 24, 24 was the Lou of 21, 21 was Lou of 1918, and 1918 was Lou of 1916 and 1917. It's all interrelated because you see they're using the in lieu of. Next page, Joe. Okay, now, what you have seen between 1918 all the way up through 1926, those tax acts, those income tax acts, followed the same basic format. The sections were all the same. You know, they, as time would go by, they'd expand the sections, you know, and get more experienced in administration of the income tax and see little things they got to clean up and clarify. You know, that's what happened. You got a new tax, you're going to learn from experience about administering it, and you're going to need to know what to clean up. And that's what they were doing. So now in 1928, they decide to come out with a new format for the income tax. Now, between 1928 all the way up through August of 1954, this format was in effect. You know, all the later acts, all the way through the Internal Revenue Code of 1939, they followed this format, which is different from the format that was in effect before this. So up until 1926, there was one type of format for the income tax. Between 1928 and 1954, there was a second format for the income tax. And then starting in 1954 with the Internal Revenue Code of 1954, you have a third format for the income tax laws, or, you know, the Internal Revenue Codes, which include more than the income tax. So here we are in 1928. And, you know, now look at what they got. They got these subtitles. Now these laws, hey, they start off with a kind of a diagram almost. You know, they got an outline, a guide. So here you got a kind of a table of contents, the section numbers. And this is real important. So, you know, I've included some of these. I can't remember if I did it in all of them, you know, because I knew we were going to be short on time. But here in the 1928 Act, you can see that they list the section numbers. So you can go down through here and see the section numbers. Sections 11 through section 63 is the basic format for the income tax. And Joe, let's go down below section 63. Okay, now they have these supplements. And the supplements are real important. Along with section 4, it's section 4, real important. But, you know, now let's see. They talk about specific taxes. So you have in sections 11 through section 63 or 64, 65, you know, that's kind of the schematic, so to speak. And in reference to the schematic, then for these parts, like going down for the page, Joe, see these subtitles? These supplements. Okay, going down below supplement D, estates and trusts. Supplement E, estates and trusts. So the specifics regarding an estate and a trust, whatever said in here in these sections, 161 through, where does the estate and trust end, Joe? Through 161 through 170, that relates only to estates and trusts. And for estates and trusts, it's determined when you read these code sections, you then stick that over to, that's how you then use the general rules set forth in sections 11 through section 63, 64, 65. Now going to partnerships, okay? Supplement F, partnerships. Oh, insurance company, supplement G. Going further down. Non-resident aliens, foreign corporations, and possessions of the United States. Now, in reference to, you know, say you're dealing with, okay, let's foreign corporations or non-resident aliens. You know, once you become familiar with the sections regarding non-resident aliens, then you will utilize the format in sections 11 through section 65, you know, the general schematic. You plug in these into the schematic in the first section. So I wanted to point that out. Non-resident aliens and foreign corporations and possessions of the United States, which relate to citizens of the United States living in the possessions and citizens of the possessions living in the possessions. So Joe, let's go on down a little bit further now. Okay. Now here's section four. Now I want to point out section four now, because we're going to see section four ultimately vanish. And there's going to be a section 63 you're going to ultimately see. It vanishes. And once you see these things, you can say, "Woo! Oh, now I see how it was built." And it's still, even today, we have section 63 of the 1938 Act still in effect. And that's real important to know. And in 1954, section 4 of the 1939 code didn't get stuck into it. So it's still in effect. And these are real important things. You know, I just mentioned it in passing. So look at special classes of the taxpayers. See the estates and trusts, B, memberships of partnerships, insurance companies, non-resident aliens, foreign corporations, individual citizens of any possession of the United States. Supplement J, individual citizens of the United States deriving a large part of their income from sources within a possession of the United States. Woo, that's real important. So Joe, let's go on down. So now, remember in 1926, the tax imposed section mentioned in lieu of? No, section 11 doesn't say a blooming thing about in lieu of. It vanished. Oh, so if you're, say, like in 1934, reading the income tax for the first time, you would look at section 11 and you wouldn't have a clue about the fact that, it's interrelated to the stuff in the past. Why? Because the in lieu of feature got stuck over into another section. So Joe, let's move on down. So now the tax is imposed in section 11 and we're moving over to section 63. Oh, look what they did. The tax, under the 1926 Act, sections, Joe, I can't move it over a little bit because on my screen, that's good. On what I'm looking at, I have this bar over here to the side that has all of us. Maybe if I minimize that. That did it. Okay. Now I got rid of our ugly mugs. So now section 63, remember the tax imposed section in section 210 of the 1926 tax, it said in lieu of. So now they carve out the in lieu of feature and stick it over into section 63. Oh, so all the taxes in this act are in lieu of the taxes imposed by the Revenue Act of 1926. Oh, so the 1928 tax was really a tax imposed in lieu of the one in the Revenue Act of 1926. 26 was in lieu of 24. 24 was in lieu of 21. 21 was in lieu of 18. And 18 was in lieu of the tax imposed by 1916, 1917. It's all interconnected. So until we get up to the 39 code, it's going to be basically the same thing. Joe, let's quickly move on through it.